Good afternoon. I'm William Babish, registration number 1162, appearing on behalf of appellants Zachary Fletcher and his father, Tony Fletcher, who were, Zachary Fletcher was an individual who was present when a vehicle came through the entrance of a store and killed his mother, and he was injured. Defendant business owner, landowners owe a mother and child that they invited into their shopping center and into their store the highest duty that owners can owe under the PLA. They are obligated to exercise reasonable care to protect against dangers of which they knew or through the exercise of reasonable care should have known under the PLA. This incident was foreseeable. Defendants have said that foreseeability, they cited a case from the federal court saying foreseeability is synonymous with should have known. And Judge Jackson in the federal court said similarly in the Axelrod case cited to this court. Defendants should and did know that cars failed to stop at the end of drive lanes. And that's for a multitude of reasons. It's a fact of modern life that there's sticky gas pedals these days, there's inebriated drivers, there are incompetent drivers, there are medical events such as stroke, such as heart attacks, such as blackouts, such as seizures.
Counsel, to the extent that there is some actor there, you know, the driver of the car, and whether he's subject to a heart attack or some other mechanical condition of the vehicle that he or she is driving, why doesn't that then become an intervening superseding cause of the incident that?
Because, Your Honor, it is not a intervening superseding cause because it is foreseeable. Just as seatbelts are in cars, and to have a defective seatbelt would create liability for the manufacturer, it's because we know accidents are going to happen. We know people are going to have medical conditions. We know there are inebriated drivers out there. We know that there are a multitude of reasons. There are sticky gas pedals. There are so many reasons that occur, and it's a fact of modern life. So we, as landowners, have to take reasonable precaution. We must use reasonable care to examine our circumstances, to examine our property, and then to protect the people that we've invited onto our property. That's what the obligation is under the PLA.
Isn't the obligation that you are advocating for, in fact, something of an absolute insurance policy for anybody that happens to be injured on somebody's property, whether it's a commercial property or, you know, possibly even a residential situation?
No, not at all, Your Honor.
Okay, why not? Can you tell me?
Let me explain. Because what is required under the PLA is the exercise of reasonable care. Reasonable care does not mean absolute. We take precautions and we find liability all the time where precautions do not prove adequate. We're not looking for any kind of absolutes here. We are looking for a jury determination that a landowner is required to look at the risks, to look at the dangers, and take reasonable steps, to take reasonable measures to protect those people they've invited onto their property. And so, as a result, there's no absolute guarantees, there's no absolute insurance. It's for the jury to determine what, given the circumstances, and in this case, what the circumstances were, what existed, is we had a drive lane that was pointed right at an all-glass entrance to the store that people were invited in. There was no curb. There was no bollards, those bollard posts. There were no boulders. There were no tree islands. There was an unobstructed shot into an unreinforced all-glass entry into this store. So the circumstances existing here were unique, as they always are. And that's why any kind of declaration of no duty tends to be just too broad, too general. The duty is supplied, and that a landowner has to exercise reasonable care. And that includes things he should know, dangers he should evaluate and protect against. Doesn't mean that he has to be successful. I give you an analogy that, just like in a high crime area, the presence or absence of armed guards doesn't mean you are always going to prevent all robberies. Doesn't mean that you're going to absolutely do that. But reasonable care in a high crime area might call for you to at least hire one, at least take some steps to protect those people that you've invited onto the premises.
Well, Mr. Babich, let's discuss the procedural posture we're in here, because we're looking at summary judgment, and we know that duty is a matter of law for the court to decide, and that foreseeability is one of the issues the court needs to consider in determining as a matter of law whether there's a duty. And I understand your argument is this really is an issue of fact for the jury. So in the procedural context, there is a tension, and so please, can you discuss why it's not
I'll address that.
Can decide.
The premises liability is kind of a unique area. It is supplied. Common law was supplanted by the Premises Liability Act. And under Vigil, the Supreme Court decision of Vigil, they said, look, the duty is defined by the legislature. The court input on duty says the court determines what the status of the person coming onto the land is. Are they a licensee? Are they a trespasser? Are they an invitee? And then what duty correlates with that is assigned by statute. The other thing the court can do is determine whether someone is or is not a landowner under the PLA. But the duty has already been prescribed.
And here, there's no dispute about the status, correct?
No, there's not. Everybody agrees that this mother and her boy were invited onto the premises and were shopping in the store. And they were invitees, which means that's what implicates the whole or should have known.
Counsel, can I ask you about that question about or should have known? Under common law, was foreseeability a question of law for the court to determine?
Under common law, yes.
Okay, now over here, what you're saying is should have known kind of equals foreseeability, kind of equals a question of fact for the jury.
It does, yeah.
And that's because of something the Supreme Court said in Vigil, perhaps not thinking about this particular circumstance?
I don't think it was accidental at all, because the PLA itself prescribes that. Vigil didn't make this out of whole cloth. The PLA itself prescribes exactly what the court's to do and what the court can do, and then says liability and damages are for the jury's sole determination. Now, that's not to say that a court can't ever enter summary judgment. We're not taking that position. Under extraordinary circumstances, they could. But that's different. To say no duty is altogether different than to say no reasonable person could find, which, by the way, the court didn't do here. This wasn't a decision based on no reasonable person could find. The decision in the trial court here was, hey, there's no duty because we're not persuaded on the facts, after weighing the facts and looking at the facts, we're not persuaded that there should be a duty or that this was foreseeable. And this wasn't a situation where there was no evidence, where no rational person could come to the conclusion that these landowners should have examined and should have known about that danger and taken reasonable steps to prevent it. That's why this case is not appropriately disposed of in summary judgment. That is why it must be remanded to the jury to determine whether or not these owners, based on that evidence, in the jury's view, should have known of the dangerous conditions, which there is ample evidence that they should have known.
Counsel, now, how does, I guess, the absence of building code or other, you know, architectural or engineering requirements that would mandate that a mall include bollards, how does that factor into either the court's decision or the jury's decision?
Well, it did factor into the trial court's decision, but we would submit improperly. There's no specific provision in the code on this. It's a silent. There's just general provisions of the building code. But non-violation of a non-existent specific provisions cannot rationally serve as a basis for dismissal. This is just a kind of a red herring here. If the court doesn't mind, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, that's fine. You have about 4 minutes and 20 seconds. Thank you. And before you begin, are you splitting your time between two counsel, or are you taking all of the time?
We're splitting our time.
Okay.
I'll take 10 minutes.
All right. Okay. Try to keep track of your own time. Okay.
This
thank you.
Change is at 10 or at 5, correct? So, Christopher Reeves, registration number 44329 for the tenant defendants, VisionWorks, SoWash, HVHC, and Highmark, in this case, Your Honors. Today we're here because there's this interaction between the Premises Liability Act and common law. In this case, you understand the facts. The facts are is that an individual crashed into a space that was leased by my clients without any warning, without any expectation. There's no evidence in this case that the tenant defendants had any prior knowledge of a prior occurrence on the property. There's no evidence in this case that there was any evidence of incursions in Weld County. There's no evidence that there were incursions in the state of Colorado prior to this case in July 10, 2010. What we have is a very isolated event. We are certainly not taking the position, and my clients are not taking the position, that it's unforeseeable that a vehicle will go out of control and strike a fixed object, whether it be a building, a person, an animal, a fence, whatever it may be. That, though, confuses the issue. The issue is not the mere possibility of an action actually occurring. It's the probability. The test under the Premises Liability Act, and also in the common law, as always, whether it was reasonably foreseeable. Our argument in this case is that car incursions into buildings are not reasonably foreseeable.
Mr. Reeves, can you address the point that under the PLA that the question is no longer a question for the judge as a matter of law, but that it's a jury question?
Yes. In 1971, in the Mile High case, the Supreme Court disbanded the classifications of trespasser, licensee, and invitee. In 1986, the General Assembly said, we're going to reinstate those classifications. In 1971, when it instituted what was thereafter called the Unity Standard within premises liability, it left in place foreseeability as one of the determinators of whether or not there was a duty. In 1986, when the Premises Liability Act was first enacted, because then it was reenacted in 1990 because it was found unconstitutional, on a different issue. It left in place the foreseeability. Under the Premises Liability Act, you still have to demonstrate before a duty may attach that the landowner knew or should have known. Even plaintiff's counsel or the appellants admit that in order for a duty to attach, you have to know or should have known.
Is it your position that the 1986 statute essentially resurrected the protections that had previously been identified with respect to invitees, trespassers, and licensees?
Not completely. In fact, there's been case law on that that says that open and obvious is no longer available. But the visual case, which is often cited in this, on page 328, the language that says the only thing to be determined is classification. Well, I would ask the court to look at page 330. The top of the very first paragraph going into the second paragraph, where it says, actually, they can still litigate whether they owe a duty based upon knowledge or lack thereof. So even in the visual case, even though it was cited by the district court in the Aurora shooting case and other different cases, There's actually language, even with some visual at page 330, that says that those defenses are still available. We know that that plays out because we've seen at least four opinions from either this court or the Supreme Court evaluating knowledge, even under the Premises Liability Act. So we know that the Supreme Court by no means intended to remove foreseeability or knowledge as a consideration as to whether or not a duty attaches to a landowner. Now, in this case, some of the recent case law from April 13th of this year made it very clear that as it relates to tenants, their only duty is the lease space. In this case, my clients did not control any common element of the parking lot, any curbing or lack thereof, any bollards, any planters, any sidewalks. That's undisputed by even the mall appellees in this case. The only thing that we controlled was a glass entrance, probably about the size of your bench. And in the middle of that was two glass doors. When my clients moved in, the glass entrance was there. I believe maybe solid doors were in place initially and they turned them into glass doors. But nonetheless, the same glass facade was there. Plaintiffs argue in this case that my client nonetheless has a duty to institute and insert steel beams into the entranceway and place the burden upon the tenant to prevent car intrusions. That's clearly in contradiction of the Premises Liability Act. Under, I believe it is section 132115, paragraph 1.5D, it says, this act is enacted to promote commercial enterprise and to foster affordable insurance. I can think of nothing that would compromise commercial enterprise more than putting the onerous of protecting occupants within the buildings than to make them have to pay to insert beams and structures within the lease space to protect them from dangers outside the space. So.
Council, we know that there are car mishaps all the time. And, you know, perhaps we're more familiar with carts hitting a guardrail. But it's hard for me to understand how, you know, car hitting a window is so unforeseeable as a matter of law, such that no duty would attach. Especially when we've got an analysis from our federal district court in the Trainum case, the Aurora shooting case, where, you know, and I know that one was on a motion to dismiss rather than a summary judgment motion, but even something as horrific as foreseeing that somebody's going to go in and commit a mass murder in a theater, you know, the court wasn't willing to say that as a matter of law, this shouldn't go forward.
And I think you saw in my brief, I took issue with the standard that was laid out as to what is foreseeable as a matter of law in that case. Mm-hmm. In that opinion, the judge actually said that landowners have to go as far as to derive at what future acts will be created by even deranged individuals. Now, if you've ever dealt with a deranged individual, you know they're highly unpredictable, not very reliable, and all but unexpected. So the idea that foreseeability, effectively it eviscerates foreseeability if that is the standard in this case, that pretty much any act, if I see a pebble roll down a hill on I-70, I therefore must conclude that a boulder is coming next. That is the analysis for which the Axelrod case would have us believe. I don't believe that's true. Under the McMillan v. Hammond case, the 1965 case, it specifically said no man can be expected to guard against events for which are not reasonably anticipated. It's the mental thought of the person. And the jury's asked that. We see it in the jury charges. You know, similarly situated individual, are they being reasonable under those circumstances? Especially in light of the tenants who are providing ophthalmology services. They are not thinking about what's going on in the parking lot. They're thinking about, is there adequate parking spaces, maybe? They're thinking about, is there adequate lighting in case we operate past daylight hours?
But shouldn't that be a question for the jury? I mean, I'm not saying that you do away with foreseeability and looking at, was this reasonable under the circumstances, but why isn't this a question for the jury to decide?
It's not a question for the jury to decide because we're still at the level of duty. is there a duty? And in order for a duty to attach, you have to know or should have known. That's maintained even after the common law was disbanded and changed by Mile High, and even as the General Assembly reenacted, to some extent, the common law in 1986 and then again in 1990. I don't believe by any means that the General Assembly or the Supreme Court has effectively said foreseeability is now only a jury question. And in fact, that would be the restatement third, which is the Rodriguez case that the plaintiffs are in the appellant's site, for which is clearly not applicable to the state of Colorado. So, the only other issue is I would go to your question about superseding intervening acts. And here, because the act was not foreseeable, we were not the landowner, even under the Premises Liability Act, for any of those conditions that the appellant's complaint should have put us on notice that we had a risk outside our door that a vehicle could come crashing 50 and cross 50 feet of sidewalk into our building. So, and no active act caused or contributed to this loss. It is a tragic loss, there's no doubt about that. But the idea that somehow or another a tenant is responsible because a car comes crashing into their building is not supported by the law in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ben Schwarzendruber, number 37074, on behalf of the Greeley Mall defendants. You know, I think this is a case of the plaintiffs are trying to impose an absolute obligation of the on the landowners as insurers of the safety of their patrons. Mr. Reeves covered it well. This really isn't something that was foreseeable, and the Premises Liability Act requires the foreseeability analysis in determining duty. I don't believe the Premises Liability Act abrogated the court's ability and obligation to determine whether a duty was owed in the beginning before it ever gets to the jury, and that's the stage of the proceeding we're at. With respect to the mall owner at the time of the accident, one thing to keep in mind is this was a property that was built by architects and engineers a couple years before we bought it. We didn't design it, had no role in the layout. We just bought the property, maintained it in the status quo. It complied with all building codes. By all means, it was a normal, typical layout that you can see at any commercial space around town. If you've been to your grocery store lately, more likely than not, you could probably drive your car straight through the front doors unimpeded. And I don't think there should be any duty on the part of landowners to be an absolute insurer of the safety of the patrons in the store.
But isn't the landowner, why shouldn't there be that duty? Isn't the landowner in the best position to prevent something like what happened here?
Well, I guess it depends on the circumstances.
I mean, even if you just go to, like a rent-a-car company, if you have those little spikes, I mean, that would prevent somebody from going in the doors.
But there are a host of other considerations that you have to take into account. At this mall, you have to take into account accessibility requirements. They argue that this was a dangerous condition because there was no curb. Well, technically it's a zero curb, so there's no separation between the grade. But there are cases out there where the curb didn't do anything. It just launched the car airborne and created perhaps more of a danger. So while a landowner has control of the property, that goes to the question of whether they're a landowner in the premises liability statute. You can't foresee and plan for every conceivable possibility and prevent accidents from happening. They're asking you to determine duty based on hindsight, and you just simply can't do that. You have to take into account what was known to the mall and the tenants at the time, and this is not something that could be foreseen.
Well, this, what you're asking is for a weighing of factual issues in this particular case. So really, is it a court's duty as a matter of law to then do that weighing to arrive at whether there's a duty, or is this something for a jury?
It's, I think it's always the court's obligation to determine whether a duty is owed before it ever gets to the jury. And that's what the court in this case did. But the court also, in response to Mr. Babish's point, that he said the court never determined no reasonable jury could find there was breach here, essentially. But the court did, if you look at pages 5 and 6 of the order, I think, say that this was such an unprecedented and so extraordinary event that no reasonable person would expect it to incur. So I think you can find that the court, like the court did, even if you get beyond the duty analysis, which you shouldn't, no reasonable jury could conclude the property owner was breached the duty.
You know, we've talked about the duty on reasonable care or to exercise reasonable care. We've talked about of conditions that you should know or should know. Is this really a question of would this qualify as a dangerous condition? Is it a separate question apart from what you should know or not know? But is this a question as to whether or not it's a dangerous condition?
Well, I don't think you need to get to that question. Under the Premises Liability Act, the landowner can only have responsibility for injuries that occur by reason of the condition of the property. So I guess you have to weigh that when you're determining that. But in this instance, it's not a injury that occurred by reason of the condition of the property. It occurred by reason of the errant vehicle caused by Mr. Lane's unfortunate seizure.
But that goes to the intervening superseding issue, right? I mean, the statute, and the court cites to the statute, but then I'm not so sure that it's applying the statute. I think the court took a detour. It was supposed to be looking at whether defendant's unreasonable failure to exercise reasonable care to protect against dangers of which they actually knew or should have known. Everything about that statement, which is what the PLA provides, suggest fact question, unreasonable, reasonable care.
Go ahead,
Marcia. Should have known. I mean, it's all fact-based. How can the trial court make those determinations?
Well, as part of its duty analysis, I think it's required to make that determination, whether this was foreseeable and it determined in these circumstances, it wasn't. So there was no duty owed.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. And we'll go ahead and give an extra minute and 20 seconds on rebuttal. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. We have a fundamental disagreement. The statute itself says the duty is to exercise reasonable care with respect to dangers that are known or through the exercise of reasonable care should be known. That's not before the duty attaches. That's the duty. That defines the duty. And so when they try to say there's still some sort of threshold determination that needs to be made before whether the legislature's defined duties attaches, that's nowhere to be found in the PLA.
Well, is it your position then that there's just no inquiry to be made to determine what should have been known or whether there's a danger?
No, as I say, it's permissible for the judge for the court at the trial level to make inquiry on a if no reasonable person, no reasonable juror could find or that the evidence so overwhelmingly and inarguably points in favor of the defendants and that no rational jury could come back in favor of the plaintiff, summary judgment could still enter. That can still happen. But what can't happen is the finding that we're going to carve out of this duty that the legislature imposed and say there's an exception. Landowners, you don't have to worry about exercising reasonable care with respect to property from being intruded upon by errant vehicles. We're just going to carve that out. There's nothing in there that allows that. And so, Your Honor, the trial court's decision in this matter was that there was no duty, and that's what we are reversing or seeking to have reversed here, Your Honor. The trial court also can look at status. They can make the determination if somebody invitee or somebody a licensee or are they a trespasser. The trial court can also determine whether somebody's a landowner. So there is certainly things that the jury, that a judge can do to say there is no duty here because you're not a landowner under the PLA. In that sense, they can make a duty determination, but only in that sense. Again, not to carve out or contract the legislatively prescribed duty about reasonable care against dangers that are known and should be known. Council makes an argument that, gee, commercial insurance would go up. That's totally inappropriate, I would suggest, because certainly the costs involved in terms of lives, in terms of disruption of the businesses, disruption of the community, and disruption to everything, the cost of that can't be measured against the relatively inexpensive measures that can be taken to have protected the invitees.
Well, Mr. Babish, under common law duty, there was a balancing which may have looked something like that, but is it your position then under the PLA that doesn't exist?
Well, anymore? My point is this, that even if it were under the common law, such balancing would come out in favor of the plaintiffs in this case. The cost of a rock, the cost of even these bollards that are in the wreck, very minimal, and it weighed against the cost that are incurred when you allow landowner decides that despite looking down the barrel of a lane pointed at his all glass doors, and by the way, with regard to these glass doors, this tenant did have the obligation as to the doors, to the entryway. They did rebuild, they did move and alter glass. And if you're going to say, this is when they moved in, if you're going to say, look, this is a good place, we really like this. I'm not saying in all places you've got to put reinforced steel or reinforced bricks or have an 18 high inch wall, but if you choose to have all glass, you ought to consider the site that you're at. And you have an obligation to, if you're protecting your invitees, to look out the window and go, you know what? We have to protect with some steel here because this, any car that fails to stop will be in our store. And I would tell the court, this car did not stop just by breaking the glass. This went full into the store because there was no impediment presented at that door. It was essentially an all-glass, unreinforced door, so it was able to travel full length into the store where the mother and her son were to kill the mother as well as an employee and injure the son. He was reportedly pushed out of the way by the mother as the truck came through and killed him. Let me, with my 37 seconds, just with respect to curbs, I would note that a whole bunch of other jurisdictions relied on by the defendant really turn upon whether there's presence or absence of a curb. It does make a difference. The speculation about what a curb will or will not do, it's immaterial because curbs can do things. They are recognized, they are used, they can stop vehicles, they can deflect vehicles, they can blow out tires, they can pull people's foot off the accelerator. There is a reason for curbs. And just ask.
Well, your time is up. Okay.
Get a minute, huh?
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you all, counsel, for your very helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.